I wanted to cook expensive ingredients. I wanted to, and something pulled me towards London. I believe what that pull was, if I wanted to cook those ingredients, I would have to go where the money was, London.
Yeah.
The kind of establishments that would have these ingredients. So I thought, right, off I'll go. I wrote a letter to the Royal Garden Hotel, and I had a telephone interview. I didn't have to travel down. And I was offered a job straight away.
Amazing.
And from my £9 a week, suddenly I was getting paid £27 a week for a job. I was doing the same job, but going to college in my own time, which was the same anyway. So I said, well, I'll enroll in college when I get down, and off I go. I arrived in London. At that time, it was quite a move for a person so young. I still wasn't 17. And I arrived in London, got to the Royal Garden. They had living in accommodation, and off I started. And I was very fortunate. I worked with some very, very good chefs. It was a very big brigade, a very busy operation as well at that time. My first day there was a banquet for 400 lunch and a banquet for 300 dinner.
Wow.
So the kitchen was, and it had other things happening. And they had a French restaurant called the Royal Roof Restaurant. And it was a great restaurant. And it was up on the 10th floor. It's now a Chinese restaurant on the 10th floor. But at that time, it was the Royal Roof Restaurant. And I worked in the main kitchen on two or three sections. And I said to the chef, I said, chef, I want to go and work upstairs. He said, John, they're all French. He said, you've got two Japanese and the rest are all French. You'll not be able to cope. I said, I beg your pardon? I said, do they not speak English? He said, very little. I said, that doesn't matter. That's what I want to do. I want to cook like them. I don't want to do this. I want to cook. And I pushed him, but he did like me. And anyway, this was a sort of a form. But what happened at the same time, I was becoming very, very homesick. And after a year, I actually said, sorry, chef, but I'm going to have to leave. I need to go back home. And I remember telling my mom, I came back in the Northeast, started in a hotel. They gave me another rise because I had London experience.
Right.
And I started. And this is the God's honest truth. We're going back to potatoes. And there was this young lad who was probably 2 or 3 years older than me, running the vegetable section. I went on to the vegetable section. And he had this big pot of potatoes that had been, I don't know if you know what a potato rumbler is. It's a machine, a big, big machine. You put potatoes in, they spin around, and they take the skins off, but it bruises the potatoes. They're not great machines, but they used to be used then. And he had taken some new potatoes and put them through the rumbler, and they didn't look particularly good, and they were bruised left, right, and center. But there was 100 portions of potatoes in a big pot. And he said, can you give me a hand to put this on the back there? And there was two bricks on top of the stove, because they were gas stoves then and hard plates. And he put them on there, and I realized the time, it was 12 o'clock. And at 12 o'clock, I said, you know, this is a little bit late to be putting these potatoes on. They're going to probably take an hour and a half to, you know, half an hour to come to the boil at least. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he said to me, no, there's no worries. Just put them on the brick, and that's definitely going to take an hour and a half. And I said, but they're not going to be cooked. He said, yeah, but they will be by 2 o'clock. Otherwise, they'll be overcooked at 2 o'clock. There's something not right here. And I spent three shifts in this establishment. And then I remember going home and I said to my mum, Mum, I've left. She said, what? I said, I've left. She said, I can't believe it. I said, no, I know what I'm doing. I said, yeah, I've told you I'm homesick, but I know it is the biggest mistake that I've made. While my mum was still sitting there, I picked the phone up. I telephoned Remy Fougere, the executive chef of the Royal Garden where I'd just left.
Yeah.
I said, chef, I've made a big mistake. He said, oh yeah, what's that? I said, I shouldn't have come back up north. I want my job back. He said, I'll see you on Monday. So I didn't really leave. I had a small excursion up in the northeast, and that was it. I knew then that I had to overcome everything and just get on with it.
Yeah.
And so off I started back in the Royal Garden.
That you made, you kind of, you know, just had to get over the fact of not being at home.
Yeah.
Getting over that comfort factor of being, I guess, you know, you guess you were just so homesick you had to go back. But yeah, it was more important to you to have that good career and a good kitchen to work in. 100%. And have that skill around you.
Yeah, it's, you know, even this, when I went into that kitchen, I still smell the aromas that I didn't like. I didn't like, now this goes back to the talk. Everybody used to wear tocks and things then, but the tocks were not clean that the people were wearing, because they were starched hats. They were old-fashioned starched hats. And, you know, if people would get marks on them and touch them, and of course they didn't always, they didn't represent the cleanest things, and I didn't like that. I didn't like the aromas in the kitchen. And that was it for me. I said, no, I don't want to work somewhere that the smells are not good. So I immediately went back down to the Royal Garden. I spent another 6 months in the main kitchen, and I went to see Mr. Fougere again, and he said, okay, we've got a position upstairs. We're going to let you go upstairs. And then I spent time in the restaurant on all of the sections as a commis. I finished my college. I carried on working, and suddenly there was a situation that arose, and the executive chef came up and he says, you're doing quite well. He said, do you think you can manage the sauce? Because he had called me in to speak to me about this. And I said, what do you mean by that? I said, I've done it with Paul. I've done it with Rene. I said, you know, I know exactly what they're doing. He says, can you cook the sauces? I said, anything I can't do, I'll make sure that I make sure that it is done in the right way. He says, well, that's good. He says, because I've just fired the sauce here.
And I didn't have a choice.
Okay. And I thought, wow, he thinks that much of me.
Yeah.
And I was willing to do whatever for that man. And he used to, there were certain times, our restaurant was only open at dinner. And we used to start about 2 o'clock and finish at about 1 o'clock in the morning. And for at lunch, he would often do very special functions up in that room. And it was usually when the car show was on, but he used to cook them personally. And that was the only time you ever seen him cook. Mm-hmm. But he used to call me and say, okay, you're coming to do this party with me. And I'd say, yeah, lovely. And that was when I really learned how good of a cook he really was, because he was the executive who didn't really do that much. And I remember one particular dish was a wild duck. And he did it with sweetbreads and oysters and a truffle sauce. And this is the God's truth. Just on this banquet, and I thought, this is amazing. And I entered a competition in Olympia, and it was the duck. It's still, this competition is still run today, but at the time it used to have 60 entrants for the senior. Now I was, at that time, I think I was 19. And generally speaking, the duck competition was for 21-year-olds and over. And I thought, I'm going to do it anyway. I didn't care. And I ended the dish, and I was in the first heat, and it was that same dish that I had modified with Remy. And The chairman of the judges came up after the first heat. I think it was 10 people in the first heat. So there's six more heats. And it was a very prized competition in Olympia at that time. And he came up and he said, "How do you feel?" I said, "Yeah, I'm okay. Yes, thank you. Thank you." And I didn't know what he was really referring to. He says, "Did you enjoy that?" I said, "Yeah, I think I got the job done. I'm very happy." And the duck dish, I wanted to show the duck dish because my boss cooked this dish and I was inspired by it. He said, did you do it well? And I said, "Well, I hope so." Because I couldn't really be 100% sure. He says, "How do you feel?" And I thought, why does he keep asking me this? So there was a heat that I watched straight after, and he came straight up and he says, "How do you feel now?" I said, "I think I'm okay." I still hadn't clicked. I think it was naivety. And lo and behold, I had to go back to work. So I was not able to see because there were hour slots.
Right.
And the very next morning, I got a telephone call and they said, "You weren't here to pick up your prize." And I said, "What prize?" They said, "You won the gold medal for the duck."
Wow.
And I thought, Lincoln, heck, I wasn't even there to receive it. And I told my boss, and he knew that I used to sort of copy things he did. And he had a Mont Blanc pen. And this was, what, 1978, 79? And he gave me, from the hotel, £100. And he said, "You'll be able to get your Mont Blanc," because I always just tell him, "I want one of them." He's always wearing a Mont Blanc there. Now, anybody that knows me, I've always got a Mont Blanc. And I had this Mont Blanc fountain pen, and I bought it on the back. I think it was £110, and I got a £100, so I had to pay the extra 10. And I had that pen for, it must have been about 40 years, and somebody stole it, and it was desperate, the fact that somebody stole it. I don't know where it went. It just vanished. And it was a very old school Mont Blanc, but it was something that really reminded me of him molding me as well, because he did. He fathered me in so many different ways. And I used to often get opportunities to move around because I was moving up the ranks. I stayed with him 7 years, but I also, when I was in the roof restaurant, as I said, we started at 2 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There was a restaurant called Mac Cuisine. Now, Mac Cuisine was the first restaurant, along with the Gavroche, to achieve 2 stars in London. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic little restaurant. There's only about 35 seats, and they used to do about 45 lunches and about 50 dinners. And they used to work 5 days a week, so it was packed, packed, packed. And a friend of mine managed to, I said, "I'll go and work for them 3 days a week, but I can only work from the morning start." And they used to start at 8:30. And I said, "I have to leave by about 2:15 because I have to get into work." And
they were in the Royal Garden Hotel at this point.
Yeah, I was still working there.
Yeah.
But I didn't get paid for it. I just went to get experience because it was such a different way of working. And Guy Mouiron was the chef patron. And they were master at delivering food. What used to really impress me, his wife was the front of house. He was the chef, and he had 3 Japanese and 2 French guys. Mm-hmm. And the way that they cooked, everything was cooked what we call à la minute. They would have their base sauces, and then everything was just cooked at the moment. And they used to go, "La belle, la belle," and they'd ring a bell, and the waiter had to be there, and off they went. But the most amazing thing was his wife used to, for a lunchtime, used to have a list on the menu. She didn't look at the menu. She said, "Right, give me the list. How many portions you've got of this? How many portions you've got of that?" And she would just come in and she took all of the orders and she'd just mark off everything that she had sold and then move on to the next thing. And I promise you, there would be 1 or 2 portions maximum. Everything would be sold. So it was sold on the day, on the spot, as freshest product that you could. And it was something that really penetrated my mind about the delivery of great food being just cooked at the right moment, but making sure you utilize every single thing. So that was a great experience. It built me up and learned me other things, especially on the business side. And I was moving up the ranks. I then became sous chef. Remy decided that I need to do some more banqueting and larger. They also had a restaurant on the ground floor then. It was like an international style restaurant. And I worked all over in the Royal Garden. I don't think there's any place where I didn't physically work. And he said, you're going to come down, you're taking care of the smaller parties and things like that, the specialist ones. And I did that for a while. Then he promoted me up again until I became premier sous chef. But there was a position of sous chef came up in the restaurant and he was a bit stuck to get someone. He said, do you want to go back up there? I said, let me go back up. That's my home. I'm going back. So I went up there as sous chef. I was only 21, which was outrageous. I had guys that were 36 standing on the stove. So it was slightly out of kilter, but he had great trust in me. And he was like a father, and he was nurturing me from a distance. And then I started writing menus. Chef, I need to have this. Chef, I need to have that. And he'd buy it for me, and, you know, and it was an amazing time.
Sounds like an amazing
tool. Yeah, he knew how to handle me. I think that's the truth. He was a little bit more. I felt he was like a father. I had a lot of people when I was young who took an interest in me and were very good to me, because in those days, as a young Geordie, you'd be feeling quite inferior and in how people would take the accent. I think it's a very different environment nowadays, but then it was almost as though you could be second-class citizen, but I wasn't. They were pushing me. Mm-hmm. And I really did feel very comfortable. I was very pushy at times. I was also very obedient with what the rules were, but I would try and push boundaries and try and say, we need to do this, we need to. And he really did allow me a space to work within every now and then. Of course, he would say, just do that. Don't do that. Just do that. Mm-hmm. And he was always letting me do, push boundaries is the one of another word. But as it was progressing, I stayed there a total of 7 years. And I had done most of the kitchen. And suddenly I had opportunities to move in various areas, which I never went for one reason or another. There must have been times when I said, I'm leaving. And they would come back and give me a rise, or they would tell me this and that and say, you know, you have to educate yourself. And the last time when I did have one opportunity, and that was a very important moment where I went to Mr. Fougier and I said, I'm leaving. He said, you're leaving? He said, that's ridiculous. I said, no, I'm leaving. And he sat me down and tried to persuade me. He said, where are you going? I said, have you heard of Albert Roux? He says, of course, Albert's a friend of mine. I said, well, I went to see Albert Roux this morning. He hasn't got a job in the Gavroche, but he has a man who is opening a restaurant. And he said, who's that? I said, I think his name is Pierre Kaufman. And he's opening a place called Ton de Claire. And he said, yeah, but that's not right for you. I said, no, I'm going this time. This time I'm going. So then that night, the general manager, Mr. James Brown, who still comes and sees me to this day, comes and sometimes has a lunch with a couple of friends in my office. He sat me down. And it was very, very important advice. He said, okay, young man. He says, what's this I hear you want to go? I said, I want to go to this restaurant. It's a new restaurant. You don't know anything about it. I said, true, but I've been told that it's going to be very good. He said, that's not the point. He said, I'm a general manager. Let me tell you how I look at things. He said, so you want to become a chef? I said, I want to become a chef. He said, what kind of a chef do you want to be? I said, I want to be one of the best. He said, okay, there's certain things that you have to look at. He said, in my position in a hotel, for you to become a head chef in this hotel, if you were coming from a small restaurant, I wouldn't even look at you. I said, why? I said, if I learn how to cook the good food, he said, there's much more to that. He says, you have to understand how to manage. You have to understand how to place people, to build a team, to do this. And suddenly I went, oh. And he was able to persuade me, and he used to call me his secret weapon. And we had a little chuckle about it a couple of years ago. I said, can you remember what you used to call me? He said, I remember, yes. He said, I can remember the conversation I had with you to sort your head out. And it was just, as a career thing, it's something that did stick, to learn how to manage. And if you think how bad some of the kitchens have been probably in the last 30 or 40 years of chefs not being able or taught how to manage and how to manage people. That's one of the biggest problems we have. Because what we do is we are creators. And it's just making sure that you create, you follow me and create like this and that's it. Whereas they should be stepping back at time. And how can we teach these people to recreate this? So it was a very important factor. So on that occasion, I still did stay.
And in hindsight, are you happy that you stayed?
Yes.
You are.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, it's, I don't really have any regrets on anything I had. I had opportunities. I did try to go to France, but that didn't quite work out. But the good thing about this, I carried on working, and then suddenly Remy came to me. I'll never forget this. He said, John, I think it's time for you to leave. I felt like he was sacking me. I said, what? He said, yeah. He said, do you know why? I said, no. He says, I've just bought a restaurant and you're going to become head chef. And I remember that it's quite an important moment. He invited me for dinner with she was my fiance at the time. He says, come for dinner and we're going to have a discussion about it. And I arrived at this house in Denham, Denham Village. The next door neighbor was Cilla Black. And he's a very famous English actor. He's one of the most iconic English actors there is. I'll remember it in a minute. And the house was absolutely stunning. And I said to myself, if this is what head chefs get, this is what I've got to do. And he said to me, so you're going to be a director of the restaurant. You're going to do this, we're going to do that. You'll learn how to do the business and we'll build it up. I said, okay, we're off. And we opened that restaurant. The restaurant was basically an Indian restaurant before. We basically did everything ourselves, from kitchen. There was people that came in and tiled the kitchen and things. But I revamped whatever we had. We had a bit of space. And they actually did the front of house themselves.
Mm-hmm. And this is the beautiful crocodile.
Yeah, and that was in Kensington Church Street. So it was just up the road from the Royal Garden. And we opened up and it was a little bit quiet for the first couple of weeks, but I was working extremely hard. It was probably the hardest I ever worked in my life, that's for sure, to set it up and make it work. And I used to get up twice a week at about 4 o'clock in the morning and go to the markets, because at that time, all of the great French chefs used to advertise themselves as going to the market, and everybody was copying that in England.
Yeah.
And myself and a friend, chef, we said, we are going to do that. And we used to go to the markets, and it's amazing the money we saved. Remy, I used to say to Remy, I'm going to the market. He says, oh, here's 100 quid, quick, go. It was because it was saving so much money. Mm. I was probably 2/3 of the value, you know, taken off the price.
But also there's a romance about knowing that the chef who's cooking for you has gone out, gone shopping himself and chosen the ingredients.
Yeah,
there's something, it is. There's something so lovely about that.
But it's also very inspirational for the chef. When you, if you have no concept of what you're going to do in walking around a market and you get the smell of the melons and things like that, or fruit that you're there, you go and buy them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that inspires you to cook in a very, very specific way. So I was learning about business, about costs, about quality, and I was really, really working extremely hard. As I say, I would work 6 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
I was basically doing the market up to twice a week. And then I would work through, basically my normal working day would be 8:30 until about 11:30 at night. And when you do that 5 days, my half day was Saturday. I used to start at 12 o'clock and finish at, you know, 11:30. But it was hard. Yeah. And when I say hard, I used to run for 14 hours a day around the kitchen to make sure we had things. And for one reason or another, I was actually looking at the whole project, because the idea was that I would take over the whole reins of this restaurant. And what happened was the chap that I used to go to the market with came in with his boss. And he said to me, you know, I think you should actually have a word with Mario Leshnik. I said, why? His boss then chipped in. She says, well, I know he's looking for a chef, and the decor of this restaurant doesn't suit the food that you are cooking.
Mm.
And it hurt.
Right.
It isn't the reason why I left, but it was something that was very poignant to me. And I had met Mario a couple of weeks before, not weeks before, a year or so before, where we had chatted about employment. And I picked the phone up and rang him. He says, why don't you come in today? So I went across to see him. And you have to remember, in those days, when you went for an interview, you had a suit, a shirt, and a tie, especially going to somewhere like Clarence. And off I went. I sat down with him. We talked. He asked me things. And he said, yeah. He says, you're the man for it. Now, I was only 27 then. I had done this little bit of experience, etc. And Mario said, yeah, I would love you to have on board. So next day, I got a telephone call from him. He said, do you mind popping in and seeing me again? I said, well, yeah, if you want, yeah. I said, the only thing is, I said, I want you to understand, if I come in, I'm not in my shirt and tie. I've just come to work, and I'm just going to be coming in the afternoon and then split. He said, that's fine, that's fine. I arrives, and he said, oh, Mr. Jones would just like to have a word with you. Mr. Jones was the managing director of Claridge's, one of the finest hoteliers, a real British gentleman of the bastion of hotels, but he was a real pure gent.
Mm.
And Mr. Jones had opened the Royal Garden. So there's an affiliation. He also knew Remy Fougère very well. And they said, well, you just pop up and see him. So I was very casually dressed. I wasn't a mess, but not what I would say suitable to have any kind of interview. So that knocked me. It really knocked me for six.
Right.
Especially when I arrived into his office. This is God's honest truth. There were some five people in morning suits.
Wow.
Sitting there, and they started firing questions at me.
Oh, good grief.
I wasn't ready for this. Anyway, I answered the questions. I thanked them very, very much indeed. And it was just questions like, how do you feel about photography in kitchens and learning? How would you teach people to make things? It was questions like that. Anyway, I said, thank you very much. Walked downstairs. By the time I got downstairs, Mario said to me, he said, you must have made one hell of an impression. I said, why? He said, Mr. Jones, he said, hire that man as quick as you can.
Amazing.
And I decided to move in. It was a very specific time because it was the moment that I said, I'm going to focus my life on hotels and on hotels only. I think it was the hard work that I had put into the restaurant. I can't tell you the energy that I had used. It was extreme. And it's a tough life. You know, I don't hide that, especially when you're building a business or really just opening up a business. It's the hardest time. And I did that for 2.5 years. And anyway, I thought I had learned a bit about business and did this, that, and the other. But my mind was very focused on becoming a top hotel chef. But it was going to be a very, very specific environment.
Right.
So I started in Claridge's. What I should tell you, I'm going to jump back because there is an important factor. While I was in the Royal Garden at the age of probably 18, I came out of Green Park Station and I literally walked past the Ritz for the first time. And inside the Ritz at that particular time, the windows on the front, as you go through the arches, there was a set of crockery that basically it was brought up from a shipwreck, which the hotel had owned. And it said for £25 extra, you can dine on this crockery, which came from this ship that they owned. And I said, 25, that's more than the meal. If you imagine something like about £200, you know, we're talking very serious money with where the value was. And I thought, wow, that's a bit special, Mr. Ritz. And I thought, you know, one day I might just, that was my first introduction to Ritz. And I thought, maybe one day I'll cook there. So I think it's important to get that point out because it was quite a significant moment.
Well, you had already said it. You'd already said it on your first date with the au pair that you were a rich chef. So
yeah.
this is already sort of, you know, put what you want out there and, you know, you can manifest it, make it happen.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting one. So anyway, I thought I should mention that element because I thought it was my first exposure. I didn't think for one minute where it was going to go, but it was a very important moment.
And just out of curiosity, does the Ritz still have that crockery?
Actually, I told the story to Sir Frederick, who was our owner, Sir Frederick Barclay, and he said, John, I still have that crockery.
No way, amazing. He has it. Fabulous. Yeah.
So that's quite an important one.
Yeah.
So I arrive at Claridge's. And Claridge's was a great bastion of tradition. You know, you were cooking for people there of the highest caliber. And that's all I can say, on the universe. You know, the Savoy Group was set up in such a way, the Savoy was for celebrity and film stars. The Connaught was the American super rich club. This is the way the Savoy Group set it up. Claridge's was for heads of state and captains of industry. The Berkeley was for the nouveau riche. So it was set out in a very specific way. And the people that came through the doors of Claridge's was mind-blowing at the time. You know, and fortunate to cook for functions, you know, they were mind-boggling. I mean, I've done 3 or 4 American presidents. There's only one people or set of people that really inspire me and make me nervous, and that's our royal family. And I've been very fortunate to do state functions for Her Majesty.
Yeah.
I've cooked lots of times for her. I cooked for her a couple of years back at a private dinner within the grounds of Buckingham Palace, which was a great honor. And I think one of the best men on this planet is Prince of Wales. He's such a clever, forward-thinking man. He's also the patron of the Royal Academy, so I've had the pleasure to have some very limited conversations with him. And I find him amazingly clever. So I feel great pride. If you tell me a pop star, rock star, or a movie star, celebrity doesn't get me at all. But special people do. And I'll tell you the story about Margaret Thatcher. That's certainly, it starts in Claridge's, but it finishes in the Ritz. So you must not let me forget to tell you that story.
Absolutely not.
So there were really people that, you know, were so high on a status throughout the world. You'd just be aghast on a daily basis. I promise you, the people that used to come in. If, just for example, you know, Princess Diana used to be a regular in the causerie, not in the main restaurant, in the causerie with her father. And, you know, nobody batted an eyelid. There was always someone in Claridge's at that time.
Mm.
And I think things have changed now in hotels where it's not quite as prevalent as they were then. Mm. But my memories of it were just amazing.
Wonderful.
And I started as premier sous chef at 27.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal, I remember distinctly, whatever you do, just try and understand what's happening before you open your mouth. And I remember staying very quiet for about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody, you know, wasn't in correct way, and I give them a very, very tough telling off. And the big thing around the whole kitchen was, we thought he was such a nice man. Have you seen him when he gets angry? Anyway, it was a building process of learning how to manage a real big team. There were some 70 chefs.
Yeah.
Everything at the start, everything was coming out of the one kitchen, whether it was banquets, whether it was restaurant, whatever. They used to have breakdown areas of where you did it. But it was such, you know, I've arrived. This is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the ingredients, you know, no matter what you wanted,
mm-hmm.
you just went out and bought it. And if it wasn't available, you got somebody that made it available. It was, honestly, that's the way it was. And the whole ethos was, you know, if the costs go up a little bit and we can justify them because it was a quality ingredient, etc., that's what you must do. But if you get the quality wrong, you would get the right telling off.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, there was a good ethos in every sense.
Yeah.
And as it was part of the Savoy Group, I think it had gone through a bad time, Claridge's. And when I joined, I wanted to put a lot of things in place, a discipline of how there were some great cooks there, but the discipline wasn't always there. And I'm a person that likes structure and organization so that everybody knows what their expectation is. And I set out to do that and concentrate and build my career. I did a lot of competitions at that time. I would, the strong competitions at the time were the Titanger, which I represented Great Britain in twice. I won the British aspect of it a couple of times.
Yeah.
You know, there were lots of different things to get yourself really out there and do what you needed to do. But my main concentration was delivering the functions, the restaurant, etc., within there. And I was building this all the time. And I had a great time with Mario Leshnik, who was the executive sous chef, the head chef, sorry. Or in those days, they were called maître chef de cuisine. And Mario was a great character. He understood me. We were chalk and cheese. He was an amazing cook, a great saucier. And we would do different things. I remember one particular function, and it was for a state function. Mm-hmm. And we were told, it was from Morocco, and we were told, you will not be cooking, you will just be assisting with the space and helping the people to deliver. They were bringing their whole team from the palace from Morocco. And off they went. Okay, that's all fine. At 10 o'clock the night before the function, I popped into the office, and the chef was, he said, can you just pop in the office? And he says, because I'm going home. I said, okay. I said, I'll finish off and then I'll be off anyway. Because we both lived north. He lived in St. Albans and I lived in Leverstock Green at the time. And just then the telephone rang, and it was one of the organizers of the dinner for this state function. And they said, we need you to do the dessert for tomorrow. I said, I beg your pardon? We haven't ordered anything. We haven't got anything. They said, well, I'm sure you can get something. I said, well, why couldn't you tell it? You know, that's what they want. So he said, what are we going to do? I said, well, can we propose some dishes to them? So we sat down, we proposed four dishes, and then waited for the response. And they said, we'll get back to you. 10:30 came, no response. 11 o'clock came. They said, okay, we can't get the king to decide. So what we would suggest is, we'll do these dishes. And we said, but we can't. Do you realize how long these will take? And they said, well, how long does it... So they made us break everything down. And there was a souffle glass with peach. And they said, how long will it take for you to make? I said, well, it will take us 3 hours to do this, 4 hours to do that. And it will take 12 hours freezing time. Because it was a large one. And they said, well, that's only 16 hours. You've got 18 hours to the function. And they went on like this. And we went through the four desserts. They said, okay, make the four desserts. And we looked at each other. And we said, we're going to be here all night. I said, okay. He said, we're going to have a team of four. There was Mario was one team. I was another team, and then we had the pastry chef and the sous chef. They had another two teams, so we broke it down. They all had three people each just to make this dessert. And off we went. We got everything together. It was the most nerve-wracking, because it is actually nerve-wracking. But I can't emphasize the kind of people. The very best, highest echelon of British society, you know, ministers, royalty, everybody's there that, you know, are really needed. And we put this together. We managed to go for a sleep at about 7 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock. And then we were back, and we still hadn't learned what the dessert was. Oh, and eventually at about 2:30, they announced it was going to be the peach souffle, which I had made. And off we went, and we actually produced this. And it was just another crazy, crazy time of how we used to operate.
Amazing.
You know, those kind of things wouldn't happen nowadays, but time changes, but it was amazing to be part of something like that. And this would, honestly, things like this would happen fairly regular to some degree, not to that extent, but, you know, somebody special came in, we need this, and that's the way it was. It was always conservative food. But it was a joy because it was everything that I wanted to cook. You know, you had the most beautiful ingredients that you had access to. But ingredients are getting better and better across the board anyway now.
Yeah.
But, you know, we did have that access, and that was something that I was so proud to be able to be part of. We rebuilt the kitchen there. There were so many things that went on, but I was getting to the age, I think I was 33. I was 32 or 31 when the Ritz head chef came up and I applied for the job.
Okay.
And it was such big news. This is the God's honest truth. In the Times, there was an article to say that someone had made a book. I don't know if it was William Hill or something like that, but they had set a book and betting on who was going to get the job as executive chef of the Ritz.
Right.
And I was second favorite. And off I went. And we had an interview. They came and ate my food in the restaurant in Claridge's. But in the end, the person that got the job, who was the favorite, was David Nichols. And David got the job, and I've still got the letter today from the general manager at the time. And he said to me, he said, "I'm very sorry, you know, basically we've chosen David because he has executive chef position already, and we need somebody that has that track record," which I said, fair enough. And I remember meeting him and saying, you know, "You've made a mistake." And he came into the restaurant probably about a year ago, 18 months. And the first thing I said to him, I said, "I've still got the letter," and he still made a mistake. So when he comes back in now, he always says to me, "I know, I made the biggest mistake of my life." But that was another thing.
So how did things change around then? How did you manage to become the executive chef of the restaurant?
Oh, it goes on a little bit longer.
Okay.
What actually happened, I was now in a position, I actually had two children. The age of 33, moving on to 33, and, you know, I got to the stage, I was living in an apartment in Cromwell Crescent in Earl's Court, just off the Cromwell Road.
Yeah.
And it was we didn't have any lifts, and it was three flights up, and my wife had two young children, and it was quite a thing for her. And I said, "We've got to move, it's time." And I was pressurizing the managing director of the Savoy Group, Mr. Giles Shepherd. And I said, "Mr. Shepherd, I'm looking for an executive position." He says, "You're going to be the next head chef in this group, don't worry." And I said, "I can't wait." And then lo and behold, I was offered a position in another hotel by he was the general manager at the time, Mr. Paharas, Raman Paharas, who was the world hotelier of the world at that time. I mean, he was a special man. And he was recruiting for a hotel at the time. And he says, "We'd like to offer you the job." And of course, when that went back to the hotel, they suddenly made sure that happened. And the chef retired. And within 4 months, I was in place in the Barclay Hotel.
Okay.
Now, I arrived at the Barclay, and I just felt it needed a good shake, really relooking at everything that we were doing, and we had to make improvements. And I set about that, but within 6 months of that happening, the same Mr. Raman Paharas joined the Savoy Group as managing director of the Savoy Group. There had been a change in management, a whole shift for all kinds of reasons after the 90s. And, you know, the group hadn't really changed and they hadn't adapted to the great pressures of the 90s, of the Gulf War, et cetera, and how the recession took in place. They didn't bother doing anything. But Raman Paharas came on board and he said to me, he grabbed me and he says, you know, I'm really pleased to be working on you, but you're the young man of the chefs in the Savoy Group now. I'm going to work on you. And it was all about managing and changing how we operated to make it a little bit more streamlined without changing anything out front.
Right.
And I said, okay. That's me. And I worked very, very hard, listened to everything Mr. Paharas had wanted. And he said, this is what we've got to do. This is how we've got to do it. And he would forever say, you know, John Williams this, John Williams that. And I thought, this is good. Because for me, it was a great opportunity. I think some of the chefs who were some of the greatest chefs of their time were saying to me, you be careful what you're doing. You know, don't do everything that they're saying. But I thought, I've got to listen to my own advice, go the way that I see is the best way forward for me. Mm. And I was only in the Barclay as executive chef for 18 months. And lo and behold, I got a telephone call from Mr. Paharas. And he said, John, he said, I have some news for you. I want you to go back home. I said, home? I said, Claridge's? He said, that's where you're going. And I cried because that's where I wanted to be. Oh. The Barclay was nothing but a stepping stone
right, for
me. And I already had the vision of which hotels I wanted to be executive chef. And I had probably three hotels that I really wanted to. I've had lots of opportunities, you know, Savoy, you know, Claridge's, the Connaught. All of these places are great, but the hotels that I wanted to work in were certainly those types. But the Savoy I ruled out after a while. I thought it was too big. I wanted to know that I could control all aspects of the kitchen. And I practiced everything. And when I got back to Claridge's, the first thing Mr. Pahara said to me, he said, everything that you have done in the Barclay, you have to do in Claridge's. So it was a great time of change, of streamlining to some degree and working very heavily within the budgets, learning and understanding budgets and understanding money, but also stretching the boundaries with what you were cooking for, whether it was a function in the restaurant or whatever. And I enjoyed the time of total rebuilding to some degree. And there was lots of change because suddenly we were plating banquets where they hadn't done that before in Claridge's.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great opportunity for me to put the stamp of what I wanted to do. And I took more control of everything that was getting into the restaurants and the dining rooms or banquets. And I thoroughly enjoyed the time. And I still say, I often go back to Claridge's and do talks for various things, especially the Royal Academy of Culinary Arts. And I always say, I'm so happy to be back in the second best hotel in the world. Because it is my favorite. I love it deeply. It's just that I'm no longer there.
And have you been to the new Davies and Brooks? Well, it's not new anymore. But...
Yes. Yeah. I had a lovely dinner there when they first opened.
Yeah.
About a team of 7 or 8 of us went and had dinner.
Stunning, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I adore that restaurant.
Yeah. You know, well, that restaurant was very different in those days.
It was, Gordon.
But it's the same restaurant. Yeah. Well, before that.
Even before that was, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I went through a lot of different things where I actually felt that I was a very good, strong maître chef of Claridge's. However, we were bought again by an American investment company, and they came and said, we want a chef to represent the Savoy Group on a world-class stage, a young man, and this is what this person will look like. And we didn't know what that meant, really, you know. But that was Gordon Ramsay. And Gordon Ramsay obviously had a restaurant in every Savoy hotel at the time. And for me, it was a little bit of a blow, to say the least. And in between, I had a couple of opportunities to go to the, I was offered to go to the Ritz, and I knocked them back twice.
Okay.
But I felt, just because I was in Claridge's and I was going through a process.
Yeah.
And because the managing director, Giles Shepherd, who had been in the Savoy, was now managing director in the Ritz for the Barclays. And he contacted me and said, I would like you to come. And he offered me the job twice. But it didn't quite click at that time. I wanted to work for him again, but it was just that moment, it wasn't the right time. And anyway, when Gordon Ramsay was brought on board, I was then placed as the executive chef and food and beverage manager. And I did a little bit more up front, and, you know, everybody was still great. The hotel was still great. It's just that for me, it was a very important factor to retain your restaurant in every sense of the word. And when you took that away, you took away my platform. And I don't believe that you should do that. I think it's one of the problems in hotels. Hotels have to spend more time, more money in making the business better. I feel that, you know, restaurateurs, what they've done is they've shown you have to invest and you have to make sure that you give the customer, you know, hospitality, the finest of food, the best kind of service. Whereas hotels were very expensive in their products, in what they were selling, and probably for the wrong reasons. But it has now changed. There's been a real, you know, evolution of how one sets about having restaurants in hotels. But it wasn't for me. I then decided I'm leaving Claridge's.